This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the Yemeni army says it has launched yet another retaliatory attack on Saudi Arabia, this time hitting Aba Airport and a military base with drones. Iran begins the second and third phases of the clinical trial of its first domestically developed coronavirus vaccine. And also in our headlines, political crisis grips German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party following its heavy defeats in two key state elections. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's 11:30 a.m. here in Iranian capital Tehran. You're watching Press TV's World News. Our top story for this half hour: Yemeni armed forces say they have launched fresh drone attacks on two targets inside Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sare made the remarks in a post on Twitter. He said the army has targeted King Khalid Air Base, located near the city of Khamis Mush'ait, as well as Aba International Airport, in the southwest of Saudi Arabia. The Yemeni army and allied Ansarullah forces have intensified their attacks against Saudi Arabia in response to Riyadh's years-long aggression against their country. The war has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead and devastated much of the country's infrastructure. Joining us now from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, we have our correspondent, Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Abdul Latif, welcome to the program. Please bring us up to speed on the recent developments in Yemen.
Thank you so much. The Yemeni army has carried out a new operation today, a retaliatory attack against Saudi Arabia. Three drones of Qassam K2 has targeted Aba International Airport and King Khalid Air Base. The drones have accurately hit the target, according to the spokesperson of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya. These attacks are in conjunction with the continued escalation against Marib. The escalation is not against only Saudi Arabia and Saudi facilities. It's also against the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. The Yemeni army continues its operations against the city. 80% of Marib is liberated, according to military sources. And we may enter a new level of retaliatory attacks that was called by the Yemeni army the Great Pain in a few days if the war on siege continues.
Abdul Latif, given the retaliatory attacks that have been carried out by the Yemenis, having that in mind, how far off are the Saudis from their stated goals when they started this asymmetrical war against Yemen?
When they have started this war, they haven't realized that the Yemenis will be attacking them in a few years, and the Yemeni army will continue developing and improving its own made in Yemen weapons. The last exhibition of the Yemeni army showed great capabilities. The Yemeni army is now capable more than ever to keep targeting Saudi Arabia. The new weapons have not been used until the moment, and this is why we think that the Yemeni army will use them in a few days if the Saudis will continue the war and siege against the Yemeni people. The new weapons will hit the oil facilities of Saudi Arabia, will cause great damage to the Saudi economy, and this is what the Saudis are afraid of. They want to preserve the face water, and they don't want to stop the war by their side. They want the Yemenis to surrender, but the negotiations will come amid the continued escalation by the Yemeni army, and the Saudis will have to accept the humiliation and the defeat as the Yemeni army continues attacking Saudi facilities and the economy of Saudi Arabia.
All right, thanks a lot. Abdul Latif Al-Washali joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Elsewhere, Tehran has dismissed a Washington allegation that Iran has been involved in recent attacks on U.S. military installations in Iraq. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht-Davanchi, made the comment in a letter addressed to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Tahrir al-Avanchi stressed that the Islamic Republic has not been directly or indirectly involved in any armed attack against any U.S. individual or body in Iraq. He, however, denounced U.S. airstrikes against the position of Iraqi forces on the Iraqi-Syrian border in February, calling them a gross violation of international law and a breach of the UN Charter. The Iranian diplomat warned that such attacks only exacerbate the already tense situation of the region and, in effect, only serve the interests of terrorist groups. Author and political commentator Kevin Barrett says the United States is trying to find a scapegoat for its illegal activities in the region.
This war criminal nation that's still committing war crimes every second that it continues to occupy Iraq is accusing Iran, Iraq's neighbor, which has actually played a very moderate and constructive role in the region, of resisting the U.S. occupation of Iraq is absurd. It is, of course, the people of Iraq who are resisting the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And they need a scapegoat. They need an excuse to blame Iran so they can continue with this false flag 9/11 agenda of going after seven countries in 5 years. They didn't get it done in 5 years, but some of these neocons haven't given up yet.
Iran has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to maintain impartiality and make comments based on technical matters. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says the issue of the supervision of Iran's nuclear program is a technical matter. He says Tehran has provided access to the IAEA according to the safeguards agreement. He made the comments following recent remarks by the agency's secretary general. Rafael Grossi had earlier said the IAEA was seeking more inspection of Iran's activities following Tehran's enrichment of uranium at higher levels. Well, Iran has launched the second and third phases of of clinical trials of one of its own homegrown vaccines. The new phases of Coviran Barakat started after receiving required approval from Iran's Food and Drug Administration. The second phase will see the vaccination of 300 people, while the third phase will inoculate 20,000 volunteers. These phases will end by late May. The first phase of the Iranian vaccine completed last month after testing jabs on a total of 56 volunteers. According to Iranian authorities, no symptoms have been observed following the first trial inoculation. The achievement comes as the country has difficulty importing vaccines due to U.S. sanctions. Iran has so far registered more than 1.7 million coronavirus cases and over 61,000 deaths. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has launched the largest mobile hospital in West Asia. The hospital was unveiled during a ceremony in the capital, Tehran. Human Abedi has filed a report on that.
Hospital with 128 beds was inaugurated by the ground force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps to give service to people amid the coronavirus pandemic in the areas that have no access to medical care. This hospital is a combination of containers and tents along with bus hospital systems that can be set up in remote areas. The commander of the IRGC ground force and the health minister attended the opening ceremony.
The IRGC's ground forces have been at the front for the building mobile hospitals. We have used these systems since 2010 in the deprived areas, especially Sistan and Balochistan province, and the southeast and northwest of the country. Today, we are launching one of the largest mobile hospitals after almost 11 years of experience in setting up mobile hospitals in different parts of the country.
The most up-to-date specialized and technical medical equipment are installed in this hospital, and it has different wards, MRI, and mobile CT scan systems as well.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus, we were thinking about the launch of a mobile hospital equipped with all the facilities needed to treat COVID-19 patients. This is the only mobile hospital equipped with PCR test facilities and CT scan systems. In addition, all the personnel and crew are particularly trained for their tasks at this hospital.
According to officials, this hospital is unique in the region, and such a facility has never been built and launched in the country. One of the special features of the new system of the IRGC Mobile Biosafety Hospital is the ability to move quickly in providing specific services in times of crisis. All the national and international standards have also been observed to provide healthcare services. The IRGC commanders told us that this mobile hospital can give services to the people in the remote areas of the country for 1 month without having access to the urban facilities. Humana Abedi, Tehran.
The Palestinian Authority has ordered a 5-day lockdown in the occupied West Bank amid a surge in coronavirus cases. Mona Candela has more in this report from Rana.
Hospitals across the occupied West Bank are full, and intensive care units operating at over 100% capacity as the number of the coronavirus patients in some cities is growing significantly. A new field hospital is set to open near occupied city of Ramallah, and some parks will be converted to field hospitals as well in an attempt to cope with the new wave of infections.
The number of patients exceeds the capacity of hospitals, in particular, the capacity of the oxygen generators as well as the beds. We've opened new wards as the situation has deteriorated. But the wards open and the numbers continue to rise, we're at 100% capacity in general, even at 110% capacity in some hospitals. That's why there's an urgent need for field hospitals, and we have information that the work will start in 2 days.
Palestinian Health Minister May Al-Kayla said earlier that the West Bank is facing a third wave of the pandemic. The Palestinian government has imposed new restrictions, including the closure of schools and universities, but it seems that measures have failed to quell rising infections among the Palestinians.
This situation is very difficult. It can be described as an unprecedented coronavirus cases spike. We were hoping not to open field hospitals, but to witness an end to this virus. After recommendations from Health Directorate and the Ministry of Health, there is an urgent need for a serious position from all the Palestinians. After 1 year, they should completely abide by the measures.
People of the West Bank demand the Palestinian Authority to import vaccines. However, the PA has managed to acquire only a few thousand doses of vaccines, not even enough for frontline health workers. As observers say, the gap between Israel and the Palestinians has illustrated the global inequity between rich and poor nations in terms of access to vaccines. UN officials and the human rights groups have expressed concerns over the disparity, saying Israel is an occupying power that is responsible for the well-being of the Palestinians.
1 year on, the COVID-19 still rages on in the occupied West Bank, with hospitals filled up amid shortage of medical equipment. This has led the Palestinian Authority to adopt new measures, including strict lockdown, to cope with the new wave of the pandemic. Mona Kandik, occupied Ramallah.
Elsewhere, Italy reimposes coronavirus restrictions across much of the country to contain a spike of virus cases. The restrictions affect three-quarters of Italy and are effective until April the 6th. The measures include closure of schools, shops, and restaurants, as well as movement restrictions. The government hopes the ongoing vaccinations and strict measures help contain the new wave that is fueled by the UK variant of the virus. Italy has so far recorded more than 3.2 million infections. The country has also registered over 100,000 coronavirus deaths. That is Europe's second highest tally after the UK. Australian women hold nationwide rallies to call for gender equality and justice for victims of sexual assault. Thousands of women gathered in front of the Parliament building in the capital, Canberra. Women also hit the streets in more than 40 cities and towns. The protests were sparked by a recent wave of allegations of sexual assault and discrimination in some of Australia's highest political offices, including the Parliament. The government has ordered an independent inquiry into Parliament's workplace culture, but critics say systemic change is needed. Director of Centre for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Mr. Tim Anderson, is joining us now from Sydney. Mr. Anderson, welcome to the program. Tell us more about these protests.
There is a wave of anger across the country, particularly by women, not just because there have been a large number of rape allegations, but because the current federal government doesn't really want to listen, doesn't want to act, and doesn't even want to listen. It won't receive or listen to the rallies themselves. But the allegations have been at the highest level. Initially, there was a series of accusations against a High Court judge. Then a young woman was apparently raped in the office of one of the ministers. Another sexual harassment was going on in another member of Parliament's office. And now the Attorney General of the country has been accused of rape when he was a younger man. So there's a ongoing series of these rape allegations, and the government is seen as very recalcitrant, not really listening, not accepting that there's any need to do anything about the culture of sexual harassment and rape.
What about the issue of changes? There is a lot of talk that systemic change is needed. What's the first step?
I think it's a deep-rooted cultural thing, you know, because this is the underlying reality here also is a range of scandals about sexual assault in schools and in universities, an ongoing thing, in colleges at universities, and it's often brushed under the carpet and not taken seriously, and I think that has been building up for some time, that sort of anger. So there's a deep cultural concern. In the particular cases, of course, there has been an inquiry into the High Court judge. There are calls now for the inquiry into the Attorney General. So, you know, there are particular circumstances where particular actions might be taken, but we are talking about a very deep cultural problem here, and it's something that the current government seems incapable of addressing properly.
All right, thanks a lot, Mr. Tim Anderson, joining us from Sydney. Elsewhere, the British Prime Minister pledges to take actions aimed at protecting women amid nationwide outrage over kidnapping and killing of a woman by a police officer. Boris Johnson has promised reviews into police's heavy-handed tactics against female demonstrators holding a vigil to call attention to violence against women. Johnson will hold a meeting with the Justice Task Force to discuss the issue. He says London police and a watchdog will conduct separate reviews into the handling of the protest. Anger flared up after Sarah Everard was found dead days after she went missing on March the 3rd. A police officer was later charged with kidnapping and murdering her. The London police chief has rejected calls to resign over violence during the vigil. More than 100 women have reportedly been killed in mysterious circumstances over the past year in the UK. Moving on, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party has suffered heavy losses in two key regional elections. Media estimations show Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party has scored its worst ever results in two southwestern states that were considered conservative strongholds. In Baden-Württemberg, a surging Green Party has taken the lead in neighboring Rhineland-Palatinate state. The left-leaning Social Democrats are projected to retain power. CDU members say the coronavirus pandemic has triggered their poor results.
The CDU and other parties could not get their programs presented, and that made the campaigning very difficult. It was campaigning in extraordinary times with an extraordinary result. And we will analyze all the external and internal influences, such as coronavirus and the Masse scandal. But those are internal issues, and internally, I can also state very clearly that the CDU remains strong despite the developments of the past weeks.
Officials from CDU's Bavarian sister party, CSU, described the results as a wake-up call, saying Germany's largest bloc needs to win back public trust. The Sunday regional elections are seen as an indication of what might happen in Germany's September general elections, when Merkel's successor will be chosen. Her government has faced criticism in recent months, partly because of a sluggish COVID-19 vaccination program and a mask procurement scandal.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Nowruz, the Iranians and Persian-speaking people's New Year, is a few steps away. Today I've come to the bazaar in order to buy the stuff needed for Nowruz. We in Iran hold detailed ceremonies on Nowruz, so stay with me to know more about these ceremonies. Setting haftin cloth is one of the most famous customs of Nowruz. Hours prior to the arrival of the new year, a cloth is spread on a table or on the floor with seven symbolic items, which in Farsi language start with the Farsi letter Sin, equivalent to English letter S. These elements include seed or apple, senjed or oyster, somag or sumac, sir or garlic, serke or vinegar, sabze, usually wheat grass grown in a dish, seke or coin, samanu or sweet food made from wheat germ, and sombol or hyacinth. Though some put sa'at or clock and sangak, a kind of Iranian bread, as the items of haftin cloth. Only seven items among these are enough to complete the haftin cloth. Meanwhile, Iranians tend to put other items such as a mirror, candle, the Noble Quran, a bowl of water with an orange floating in it, colored eggs, and traditional sweets and pastries, nuts, and green vegetables. The items vary slightly in different parts of the country. Each of these elements symbolize something meaningful, which include concepts like light, brightness, health, wealth, and bliss. I am now in the bazaar. How crowded it is. Oh, look at there. It's Haji Firuz. Haji Firuz is a popular character who oversees the New Year's festivities by singing cheerful songs and playing a tambourine. The echo of Haji Firuz songs in Iran's streets and alleys heralds Nowruz and the new Iranian year. I am now in a herbal store. I'm going to buy some sumac for my haftin cloth. I also have to buy some wide rue for my grandma. Burning the seeds of wide rue is one of the customs of Iranians, which is believed to fend off diseases and brings about health. Oh, amazing! Someone is burning the wide rue out of the store. What a pleasant scent! And I am now in a samanu making store. Samanu is a type of food which is made by wheat germ. It's sweet and very delicious. At the time of Nowruz, Iranian families make samanu all together or along with relatives or even with their neighbors. Making samanu is quite hard and time-taking. Therefore, I prefer to buy it ready-made. Succeeded in buying the items of Hafsin Klud. Garlic, vinegar, sabanu, sumac, and the hyacinth. Oh, well, I have grown the sabze myself since last week, and I have some coins. Now my half-scene is complete.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, 1 year has passed since 26-year-old Breonna Taylor was killed in her own home by Louisville, Kentucky police in a no-knock raid. She was an emergency medical technician who had no police record. On the anniversary of her brutal slaying, protesters have taken to the streets in several U.S. cities calling for justice. So far, none of the officers involved in her killing have been charged with the crime. Will this be just another dead black person where people call for justice but are unlikely to get it? I'd like to turn to Washington, D.C. and talk to Colin Campbell. Colin, good to have you with us. Well, tell us about what has taken place during this 1 year and also, of course, on the anniversary.
That's right. And we look at how much progress has been made since Breonna Taylor's death. And as we can tell, not much has been done. These people who are protesting are outraged over the constant ignorance and neglect of trying to find justice for Breonna Taylor, as there have not been any substantive arrests made in her death. We do know that there have been some money in a wrongful death lawsuit and things like that, but as far as really punitively punishing the people who are responsible for her death, the state has come very far short. Not to mention, we found out soon after the verdict came out that the attorney general really did not provide the right amount of evidence or withheld certain pieces of evidence from being submitted that would render a verdict where Breonna Taylor would not get ultimate justice for being killed while being innocently in her home. And I think that's why you're seeing so many people who are frustrated and just angry and outraged at all of this, is because it could happen to any one of them. It could happen to any one of us, where you could be in your home doing something that you do normally every day, grabbing a pot of coffee, talking on the phone with a friend or a loved one, watching television, and you could be shot dead and the person responsible for that could still walk around freely without any type of compassion or any type of punitive measure being served or any type of justice being rendered to the victim. And again, we are seeing these protests in Kentucky. We are seeing them in other parts of the United States as they look at other grievances that have come at the hands of police.
Thanks so much for that update, Colin Campbell out of Washington, D.C. Staying in D.C., I'd like to welcome Matthew Fogg, former Chief Deputy, U.S. Marshals Service. Matthew, thanks so much for being with us. Why does this just seem to repeat and repeat itself again? In your perspective, why haven't we seen any officer charged so far in the death of Breonna?
Well, thank you for having me on it. I think one of the problems is the historical issues we have in this country with law enforcement, and especially people of color. We know that it's been disproportionately applied. We know that across the criminal justice system all the way. And the problem is in law enforcement, stuff having been in it for 30 years, officers can make mistakes. I got that. I understand that. But when you see it happening over and over again for the same happening when it's a race issue, it becomes a race issue, which racism is systemic in America. Now the president, everybody has admitted to it. The problem is, how do you hold people accountable? And you've got systems and institutions in place. These officers got a no-knock warrant. They went and went to Breonna Taylor's location and ended up mistakenly, whatever you want to call it. But the bottom line is she wound up dying in that process, and nobody was ever held accountable. And what we're seeing over and over again, and I saw it in my own self in law enforcement, it's very difficult to have the whole white officers actually accountable for killing black citizens. And there were always some, money is paid out, but there's no accountability. So, and as long as the system remains in its place, you will continue to have these type of incidents. And until the government and everybody comes together and says, listen, this is a race matter. We got to deal with it as a race matter, and people have to be held accountable if they do the wrong things. And I feel when you do the wrong thing, somebody can get killed. So the bottom line is you got to start holding people accountable, and it seems like this system still is not ready to really hold culprits accountable for the things that when we do things wrong in law enforcement. Again, it's a race issue. It's going down party lines, race issues. When it seems to be an issue against black Americans, black and brown Americans.
Okay, stay with me, Matthew. Let me welcome my next guest, Yane Ndego, a writer, singer, and activist out of Philadelphia. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, you heard, hopefully, what Matthew was saying, that it is very difficult to see white officers being charged in the killing of black Americans. We know that the opposite. Listening to interviewers before of black police officers who are very careful, especially if before they want to fire at a white individual. But the other side of the coin is not the same. What is it going to take to change that status quo?
Well, I think we have to examine this from the core and from the root of where this comes from. And racism is definitely a key component, but racism is actually a tool of imperialism, of capitalism, of patriarchy, and those are the things that are really driving this. And the reason that the status quo is not being changed is because it supports the elite in the U.S. and those people who are in the ruling class who actually benefit from the discrepancies in the ways that the legal system is applied depending on the parties that are involved. And so while police officers may make mistakes, the police as a larger overarching organization and agency, it's spoken as if it is here to serve and protect all members of the community, but their really primary purpose is to protect the property owners, the people who have the most wealth. And so all of the issues of the dynamics around race actually support the stopping people from fighting against the class and capitalist issues that are in place in the U.S. because people will allow things to happen that that are inappropriate or that are wrong because it is because of their racism. and they will support things that are happening that are inappropriate because of their racism. And even if the system that is in place is not one that supports the best interest of most people in the country, and most working class people don't benefit from the current system that's in place. So we need to look deeper than even just the race concern. Race is significant, but we have to recognize it as a tool of the larger oppressive system that is used to keep working class and poor people disempowered and prevent them from working together.
Well, let me stay with you, Yanni, because let me stay with you, staying with what you just talked about as far as it being a class issue and it being a tool of imperialism. With that being the case, then why don't we see, for example, there obviously poor white individuals who are struggling, but in general, we see this continuously targeting black people, and actually sometimes it could be black people who are wealthy or middle class. So tell me, how does that fit into what you're saying?
Well, because as I said, racism, not suggesting that racism does not exist. Racism is embedded in our society in the United States. However, racism is intentionally embedded because it is a tool that is of the capitalist class. And so what ends up happening is that because there are individuals or groups of individuals, they serve almost as buffers against the ruling class. And so that is what the larger white community serves. That's how the larger white community serves. Its role is to actually keep the issues and the concerns of other communities. So it's kind of like a divide and conquer tactic. So you have like working class white people, their material interests are much more aligned with those of working class black people and working class brown people, but they fight against those individuals because of their association with whiteness, even though they don't actually gain a lot of the benefits of whiteness aside from certain much more superficial privileges. I mean, and substantial privileges like not having to be murdered by police, but by having the ability to feel that you can count on police and trust police and feel safe with police, it helps you to diminish looking at the realities that other communities are experiencing and work in collaboration with them to address the oppressive conditions that all working class and poor people face.
Okay, well, Matthew, in 2020, after George Floyd's murder, people across the U.S. took to the streets and saying Black Lives Matter and calling for accountability. What happened with that movement? Has anything changed?
I won't say necessarily that it's changed, because what I'm hearing is still Black Lives Matter. They're still continuing to gear up the protest and to try to do more things that change laws, regulations. We were just in Annapolis, Maryland, trying to get the policeman's law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights changed. But one of the things I noticed, just like I'm the class agent, we've got a class discrimination lawsuit against the U.S. Marshals Service. All of the black agents, most of them in the Marshals Service, we're all a part of a class. We've got a lot of class actions popping up all over the country in these law enforcement departments, which says internally we as the law enforcement officers recognize the racial disparities and the discrimination that's taking place within our departments. We don't want to do it anymore. We don't want to follow those patterns where you can see this, it's a pattern of discrimination and racial disparity. But when we speak out, of course, then the institution turns on us. So we are hoping now that more and more officers internally will speak out and will stop saying, no, we're not going to be serving and doing these no-knock warrants and things like this just in black communities. I've always said, if we did this stuff all over the country in the white communities where we serve drug warrants and everything else, this stuff would have stopped a long time ago. So what we have to understand is that we have to take a role, and that's where the law enforcement officers, I think, internally are beginning to step up to the plate, like I said, when we talk about these various law enforcement departments. So it is what the caller said. It is a problem that's deeply embedded that comes from a historical position in America on policing. But we can take control of it, those as black officers, when we start speaking out and standing up and saying, along with the community, we join in with the community, we say, we're not putting up with this anymore.
Well Matthew, staying with what you've just said, as far as black officers can bring about a change. However, I want to look at that because if they go against the status quo, do you not think that they will be reprimanded and many times losing their jobs? I mean, we can widen this out, actually, and even look at, for example, the U.S. military, and many minorities play a big role in the U.S. military. And, of course, as Malcolm X said, and of course, Muhammad Ali, just sending poor people to fight other black and brown and poor people around the world. So is it realistic that a change can come from within?
I think it can. I mean, let me put it this way. I've been fighting the Marshal Service for, 30 years or so throughout my whole career. I won a major lawsuit against the Justice Department. There were some changes that was made. But again, and people are talking about it, but the dialogue has to be raised. And that's where when Black Lives Matter and with the pandemic and we had Donald Trump as president, we had things that lined up that said, this is the time. So I really think right now we're in an era. We've got a new president. We've got somebody that's with a new attorney general, somebody that's speaking this language and actually admitting that systemic racism exists and law enforcement exists in all aspects of our structural system, and we have to change it. Once you get people admitting it, and then you've got people coming forward afraid, not afraid they're going to lose a job, like I lost my job. I went through everything that you could imagine when I first stood up, and now we've got critical mass where people are coming out, and law enforcement, the professionals are coming out admitting it and testifying and saying, yes, I've observed this type of racism. I see it happening. I can tell you this person, that person is carrying it out. Now you start to see the other side where people had these racist views start to back up a little bit. We got a lot of police officers, law enforcement people that are part of these right-wing groups, the sympathizers that had these jobs and were happy. And now they're feeling a little antsy because they realize now that people are watching them and everybody's on notice. So I think this is a time for change, and I think that can happen.
Well, Yanni, how can the United States make the necessary changes to ensure equality when the capitalist system itself has been established via genocide and slavery? And to really bring about a change would mean basically dismantling the system itself. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, that's really the truth, and that's one of the reasons why the system fights against change as much as it does, and the agents of the system fight against that change. I am an organizer of Black Lives Matter Philly, along with the Black Lives for Peace, the Black Philly Radical Collective, and Begin to Freedom. And one of the things that we say is there are no good cops in a racist system. And a lot of times people want to like try to boil down to individuals, but the individual can't change the system. You move one person out with their good intentions. You have one person with their good intentions. You replace them with anybody else, you know, the system is the same. So even you replace a person with bad intentions with someone with good intentions, the system is the same. And so unless we dismantle the system, even when it comes to the extraction from other countries, the extraction from Africa, the entire African continent, if the U.S. and the Western forces want to stop those extractions, their entire economies would fall. And so there has to be a willingness amongst the people to imagine something completely new and different for all working class people. But the current system has poverty, it has violence, it has homelessness, it has those things embedded in them, because it's the only way that you can continue to take the resources and give and put them in the hands of a very few people and keep them there. And so once we begin to shift and shift from a completely systemic perspective and have people understanding that reality, which is the reason why I express the fact that this imperialism and capitalism are key and that racism is a tool to them. That's my perspective, that racism is a tool of these things and that it helps to keep the people divided. Once people overcome those things and begin to recognize that there is an enemy, that the enemy is actually those who are hoarding all of the resources from the people, and that these different militarized aspects of, or these militarized arms, are actually human beings that are being used in order to diminish and to take the lives of and oppress the majority of people, not just in the United States, not even just black people, but around the world. We're not going to be able to see a difference. But we do have to still recognize that there is a substantial burden that is formed by the black and native people in the United States around this system. So even though there are people who are working class white people and poor white people that are actually suffering as well, because poverty, it goes across the board, there is an added burden that is borne by the people who are coming, who are of African descent, and the people who are native to the land, because they are needed to be the redirected as the enemies of the people, so that the people who do have the same common interests are fighting against each other and not challenging our true enemy in the ruling class.
Well, Matthew, now black people have been killed by figures of authorities for hundreds of years, and now in 2021, it's still happening. Now, there are more and more black activists who are looking at separatism as a way, believing that they will only get equity by establishing their own nation. Your take on that side of things?
Well, I think it's an expression, the cat's out the bag. I don't know if you can really try to set up a separate nation at this point, but you can set up a separate system that's determined that it will fight against racism and the issues that the fallout from it. Again, we're talking about Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and Eric Garner. We can go on and on and on. And how, in this current climate and world, and what I've seen, like I said, now what I'm seeing is if these officers are willing to come forward and law enforcement in that field, that's what we drove us to this point, willing to come forward and begin to identify the bigot cops. I'm writing a book, Bigots with Badges, and identify how we can fight the racism from within. I think we can start to see change. Now, of course, we know that our Congress and the great lawmakers in this country still, there's a racial divide, even when we look at the makeup of our Congress and everything else. And we start to address these issues seriously. Black Lives Matter, marching, coming out forward, because you've got to have protests, you've got to have people come forward and to put this thing on the front burner. And I just believe from that perspective, we will start to see changes, even with the marijuana laws, the drug laws, the things that we as cops was used all types of methods to just throw people in jail because we wanted to get our numbers up. A lot of that is going to start to change, and I'm seeing it now beginning to slowly but surely happen. So I think this is the time, and I thank God for your caller who is with Black Lives Matter, because I've always supported that particular movement, knowing that the purpose of it was to bring attention to all of this stuff. And that's the only way you're going to deal with it. Things have to be put on the front burner. We got to deal with it, and we got to let America know, us as employees, and when they try to utilize us to go against and to carry out these racist, these one-sided viewpoints, we say, no, we're not doing this anymore. We're going to stand up against it. And I think that's the viewpoint that we got to get across to America.
Well, Yanni, how do you think that the perspective that you were talking about, that basically you talked about, of course, the racial aspect of it, but in a capitalist system, it's more the haves and the have-nots, the 1% versus the 99%. So taking that in perspective, then, for example, there's a Secretary of Defense who's black, there's a Vice President who's black, but if they're supporting that same imperialist system, then color really doesn't matter. So with that being said, Yanni, do you think that more and more people are understanding the importance of the class differences, the importance of this basic war that's been declared against 99% by the 1%? And how key is that in your perspective for people to understand?
I think that there is an understanding. However, the reality of racism, the history of racism, and the differences in what people have experienced creates different interests and different levels of attachment to the current system, because people are enabled to become empowered. So you do have black people who are in positions of power, they still act as agents of white supremacy, right? And so that doesn't get transformed. You do have changes that happen, but the changes are always done in a way that still helps to maintain the status quo. A perfect example is looking at the difference between, like, we had enslavement and now we have mass incarceration. Mass incarceration is just a new way to enslave people, and a lot of the labor that a lot of people labor in these in these prisons. They're basically free labor. They can be loaned out. And so So what we have to do is we have to, as a people, we have to do the work internally to overcome the realities that have been programmed into us so that we can begin to stop functioning as agents of this oppressive system. And then we have to also recognize that we have to create completely new systems. We cannot just try to transform what's in place. We have to dismantle it and build something that cares for and takes care of everyone.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me, Yanni Ndongo, writer, singer, and activist out of Philadelphia, and Matthew Falk, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshals Service out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند این ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Leadership from the perspective of Imam Khomeini. Among the matters that the jurist should accept its responsibility is the enforcement of the Islamic Penal Code. The question here is that, is there a distinction among the Prophet Muhammad, the infallible imams, and a jurist so far as applying penal code is concerned? If jurist position is lower, should he pass a lighter sentence? Should the number of lashes received by an adulterer, adulteress, which is 100, be 150 if judged by the noble prophet, 100 if judged by Amir al-Mu'mineen, and only 50 if judged by a jurist? It is the executive ruler who should have the responsibility of putting the divine penal code into effect, no matter whether he's the prophet, Imam Ali, his representative, or a judge in Basra or Kufa, or an Islamic jurist now.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, with another program from IRB English Radio, which is Spring of Truth. We were discussing about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the religion of Islam. Imam Khomeini has said that if everything becomes Islamic, an incorruptible society will ensue. So basically, in regards to Islam, we know that in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made clear statements that Islam is the final religion, Islam is the complete religion, and Islam is the mean to take a society towards the perfection. If a society wants to have perfection in it, it should follow the Islamic rules. And that's what Imam Khomeini is also referring. And he's saying if everything becomes Islamic, if the societies, if the world becomes Islamic, then an incorruptible society will ensue. Incorruptible society. It means that Islam is against corruption. Why? Because the main theme in Islam, the main idea in Islam, is the idea of justice. And corruption is just opposite the justice. Where there is no justice, there is oppression.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
Where there is no justice, there is corruption. So if Islam talks against the corruption, talks against the oppression, and it calls everyone towards the justice. And similarly, Imam also has said that Islam is for the welfare of the society. Because Islam calls for the justice, that is why Islam is the religion that is for the welfare of the society. Because the welfare of society always depends on the system of justice. And the more the corruption is, the less the justice is. So we need to be very much careful which school to follow. Because when there is Islam, obviously, Islam always talks about the progressiveness. It is a complementary and comprehensive laws. And that's why when Imam Khomeini is saying that if everything becomes Islamic, an incorruptible society will ensue, it is because the Islamic laws are progressive, complementary, and comprehensive. Inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to follow the teachings of Islam and Quran, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Refugee camp in the suburbs of New Delhi is gripped in utter panic and despair. After hundreds were rounded last week and detained in Jammu region of Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir for possible deportation, according to police and local administration there.
We have no idea of what will happen to us. We are living here peacefully. We will survive on just one meal a day, but we urge the Indian government not to deport us because the military there will kill us. We are thankful to have got shelter in India. At least we are alive.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have been rising in India since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the Bharatiya Janata Party in 2014. The ruling party calls the Rohingya people illegal immigrants and a security threat. Many vicious anti-Rohingya campaigns in the Jammu region also called for their expulsion a few years ago, leaving the community in great distress.
Fearing arrest and possible detention, many have gone into hiding, while others are in panic. Activists say it's unfair to detain or deport them, considering the situation in their country.
Already the refugees have started calling me up, and many have already sent me messages on the phone, apprehending danger to themselves and their community. We will take to both national and international campaigning to safeguard the security, dignity, and safety of the Rohingya refugees, as well as all other refugees in India.
Human Rights Watch and other rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international law obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders. India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In a
rarely seen demonstration of unity, the French solidarity movement with Palestine showed its support for Olivia Zimmer, one of the pillars of the BDS movement. Olivia will be judged next week for her participation in BDS actions. The official accusation, anti-Semitism, an insult towards a foreign state. BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Against Israel.
There is no legal basis.